paid gig, about as deep in the boonies as one could possibly wander. Maddie continued, I drove to D.C. last year for a conference. Took me 6 hours. You want to say around 4 tomorrow afternoon? Sure, I'll see you then. And thanks, Ms. Wyatt. No, thank you. And it's Maddie. Samantha searched the web and found a site for the Legal Aid Clinic. Its mission was simple. Provide free legal services for low-income clients in Southwest Virginia. Its areas of service included domestic relations, debt relief, housing, healthcare, education, and benefits due to black lung disease. Her legal education had touched briefly on some of these specialties. Her career had not. The clinic did not deal with criminal matters. In addition to Maddie Wyatt, there was another attorney, a paralegal, a receptionist, all women. Samantha decided she would discuss it with her mother, then sleep on it. She did not own a car, and frankly, could not see herself wasting the time to travel to Appalachia. Waiting tables in Soho was looking better. As she stared at her laptop, the homeless shelter in Louisville checked in with a polite no. 10 rejections in one day. That was enough. She would end her quest to save the world. Karen Kofer arrived at Firefly just after 7. Her eyes watered as she hugged her only child, and after a few words of sympathy, Samantha asked her to please stop. They went to the bar and ordered wine while they waited for a table. Karen was 55 and aging beautifully. She spent most of her cash on clothes and was always trendy, even chic. As long as Samantha could remember, her mother had complained about the lack of style around her at Justice, as if it were her job to spice things up. She had been single for 10 years, and there had been no shortage of men, but never the right one. Out of habit, she sized up her daughter, from earrings down to shoes, and made her assessment in a matter of seconds. No comment. Samantha didn't really care. On this awful day, she had other things on her mind. Dad says hello, she said in an effort to steer the conversation away from the urgent matters at Justice. Oh, you've seen him? Karen asked, eyebrows arched, radar suddenly on high alert. Yes, I stopped by his office. He seems to be doing well, looking good, expanding his business, he says. Did he offer you a job? He did. Starting right away, 40 hours a week, in an office filled with wonderful people. They've all been disbarred, you know. Yes, you told me that. It seems to be legitimate, for now anyway. Surely you're not thinking about working for Marshall. It's a gang of thieves, and they'll probably be in trouble before long. So you're watching them? Let's say I have friends, Samantha. Lots of friends in the right places. And you'd like to see him busted again? No, dear. I'm over your father. We split years ago, and it took a long time to recover. He hid assets and screwed me in the divorce. But I finally let it go. I have a good life, and I'll not waste negative energy on Marshall Kofer. In tandem, they sipped their wine and watched the bartender, a hunky boy in his mid-20s in a tight black t-shirt. No, Mom, I'm not going to work for Dad. It would be a disaster. The hostess led them to their table, and a waiter poured ice water. When they were alone, Karen said, I'm so sorry, Samantha. I can't believe this. Please, Mom, that's enough. I know, but I'm your mother, and I can't help myself. Can I borrow your car for the next couple of days? Well, sure. Why do you need my car? There's a legal aid clinic in Brady, Virginia, one of the nonprofits on my list, and I'm thinking of driving down for a look around. It's probably a waste of time, but I'm really not that busy these days. In fact, I have nothing to do tomorrow, and a long drive might help to clear my head. But legal aid? Why not? It's just an interview for an internship. If I don't get the job, then I'll remain unemployed. If I do get the job, I can always quit if I don't like it. And it pays nothing? Nothing. That's part of the deal. I do the internship for 12 months, and the firm keeps me in the system. But surely you can find a nice little firm in New York. We've already discussed this, Mom. Big law firms are laying off, and small firms are folding. You don't understand the hysteria on the streets of New York these days. You're safe and secure, and none of your friends will lose their jobs. Out in the real world, it's nothing but fear and chaos. I'm not in the real world. Fortunately, the waiter was back, and with a long narrative about the specials. When he left, they finished their wine and gazed at the tables around them. Finally, Karen said, "Samantha, I think you're making a mistake. You can't just go off and disappear for a year. What about your apartment and your friends?" "My friends are just as furloughed as I am. Most of them, anyway. And I don't have a lot of friends. I just don't like the sound of it." "Great, Mom. And what are my options?" "Taking a job with the Kofor Group." "Heaven forbid. You'd probably end up in jail." "Would you visit me?" "You never visited him." "Never thought about visiting him. I was delighted when they put him away." "You'll understand one day, dear, but only if the man you love dumps you for someone else, and I pray that never happens." "Okay, I think I understand that. But it was a long time ago. Some things you never forget." "Are you trying to forget?" "Look, Samantha, every child wants their parents to stay together. It's a basic survival instinct. And when they split, the child wants them to at least be friends. Some are able to do this. Some are not. I do not want to be in the same room with Marshall Kofor, and I prefer not to talk about him. Let's just leave it at that." "Fair enough." It was as close to a mediation as Samantha had ever been, and she quickly backed away. The waiter brought salads, and they ordered a bottle of wine. "How is Blythe?" Karen asked, heading toward easier topics. "Worried, but still employed." They talked about Blythe for a few minutes, then on to a man named Forrest who'd been hanging around Karen's apartment for a month or so. He was a few years younger, her preference, but there was no romance. Forrest was a lawyer advising the Obama campaign, and the conversation drifted in that direction. With fresh wine, they analyzed the first presidential debate. Samantha, though, was tired of the election, and Karen, because of her job, shied away from the politics. She said, "I forgot you don't own a car." "I haven't needed one in years. I guess I could lease one for a few months if I need to." "Come to think of it, I'll need mine tomorrow night. I'm playing bridge at a friend's house in McLean." "No problem. I'll rent one for a couple of days. The more I think about it, the more I'm looking forward to a long drive, alone." "How long?"
"6 hours."
"You can drive to New York in 6 hours."
"Well, tomorrow I'm going the other way."
The entrees arrived, and they were both starving. Chapter 5. It took an hour to rent a red Toyota Prius, and as Samantha worked her way through DC traffic, she gripped the wheel and constantly scanned the mirrors. She had not driven in months and was quite uncomfortable. The incoming lanes were packed with commuters hustling from the suburbs to the city, but the traffic headed west moved without too much congestion. Past Manassas, the interstate cleared considerably, and she finally relaxed. Isabel called, and they gossiped for 15 minutes. Scully and Pershing had furloughed more associates late the day before, including another friend from law school. Another batch of non-equity partners had hit the street. A dozen or so senior partners took early retirement, apparently at gunpoint. Support staff was cut by 15%. The place was paralyzed with fear, with lawyers locking their doors and hiding under their desks. Isabel said she might go to Wilmington and live in her sister's basement, intern for a child advocacy program, and look for part-time work. She doubted she would return to New York, but it was too early to make predictions. Things were too unsettled and changing rapidly, and, well, no one could say where they might be in a year. Samantha admitted she was thrilled to be out of the law firm and on the open road. She called her father and canceled lunch. He seemed disappointed, but was quick to advise her against rushing into a meaningless internship deep in the third world. He mentioned the job offer again and pressed a little too hard. So she said no. "No, Dad, I don't want the job, but thanks anyway." "You're making a mistake, Sam," he said. "I didn't ask for your advice, Dad." "Perhaps you need my advice. Please listen to someone with some sense." "Goodbye, Dad. I'll call later." Near the small town of Strasbourg, she turned south on Interstate 81 and fell in with a stampede of 18-wheelers, all seemingly oblivious to the speed limit. Looking at the map, she had envisioned a lovely drive through the Shenandoah Valley. Instead, she found herself dodging the big rigs on a crowded four-lane, thousands of them. She managed to steal an occasional glance to the east and the foothills of the Blue Ridge, and to the west and the Appalachian Mountains. It was the first day of October, and the leaves were beginning to turn, but sightseeing was not prudent in such traffic. Her phone kept buzzing with texts, but she managed to ignore them. She stopped at a fast food place near Stanton and had a stale salad. As she ate, she breathed deeply, listened to the locals, and tried to calm herself. There was an email from Henry, the old boyfriend, back in the city and looking for a drink. He had heard the bad news and wanted to commiserate. His acting career had fallen flatter in L.A. than it had in New York, and he was tired of driving limousines for D-list actors with inferior talent. He said he missed her, thought of her often, and now that she was unemployed, perhaps they could spend some time together, polishing their resumes and watching the want ads. She decided not to respond. Not then, anyway. Perhaps when she was back in New York, and bored, and really lonely. In spite of the trucks and the traffic, she was beginning to enjoy the solitude of the drive. She tried NPR a few times, but always found the same story. The economic meltdown, the Great Recession. Plenty of smart people were predicting a depression. Others were thinking the panic would pass, the world would survive. In Washington, the brains appeared to be frozen as conflicting strategies were offered, debated, and discarded. She eventually ignored the radio and the cell phone and drove on in silence, lost in her thoughts. The GPS directed her to leave the interstate at Abingdon, Virginia, and she happily did so. For 2 hours, she wound her way westward into the mountains. As the roads became narrower, she asked herself more than once, what exactly was she doing? Where was she going? What could she possibly find in Brady, Virginia, that would entice her to spend the next year there? Nothing. That was the answer. But she was determined to get there and to complete this little adventure. Maybe it would make for a bit of amusing chit-chat over cocktails back in the city. Perhaps not. At the moment, she was still relieved to be away from New York. When she crossed into Nolan County, she turned onto Route 36, and the road became even narrower. The mountains became steeper, the foliage brighter with yellow and burnt orange. She was alone on the highway, and the deeper she sank into the mountains, the more she wondered if, in fact, there was another way out. Wherever Brady was, it seemed to be at the dead end of the road. Her ears popped and she realized she and her little red Prius were slowly climbing. A battered sign announced the approach to Dunn Spring, population 201. And she topped a hill and passed a gas station on the left and a country store on the right. Seconds later, there was a car on her bumper, one with flashing blue lights. Then she heard the wail of a siren. She panicked, hit her brakes, and almost caused the cop to ram her, then hurriedly stopped on some gravel next to a bridge. By the time the officer approached her door, she was fighting back tears. She grabbed her phone to text someone, but there was no service. He said something that vaguely resembled, "Driver's license, please." She grabbed her bag and eventually found her license. Her hands were shaking as she gave him the card. He took it and pulled it almost to his nose, as if visually impaired. She finally looked at him. Other impairments were obvious. His uniform was a mismatched ensemble of frayed and stained khaki pants, a faded brown shirt covered with all manner of insignia, unpolished black combat boots, and a Smokey the Bear trooper's hat, at least two sizes too big, and resting on his oversized ears. Unruly black hair crept from under the hat.
"New York," he said.
His diction was far from crisp, but his belligerent tone was clear.
"Yes, sir, I live in New York City."
"Then why are you driving a car from Vermont?"
"It's a rental car," she said, grabbing the Avis agreement on the console.
She offered it to him, but he was still staring at her license, as if he had trouble reading.
"What's a Prius?" he asked.
"It's a hybrid from Toyota."
"A what?"
She knew nothing about cars, but at that moment it did not matter. An abundance of knowledge would not help her explain the concept of a hybrid.
"A hybrid, you know, it runs on both gas and electricity."
"You don't say."
She could not think of the proper response, and while he waited, she just smiled at him. His left eye seemed to drift toward his nose. He said,
"Well, it must go pretty fast. I clocked you doing 51 back there in a 20-mile-an-hour zone. That's 30 over. That's reckless driving down here in Virginia. Not sure about New York and Vermont, but it's reckless down here. Yes, ma'am, it sure is."
"But I didn't see a speed limit sign."
"I can't help what you don't see, ma'am, now can I?"
An old pickup truck approached from ahead, slowed, and seemed ready to stop. The driver leaned out and yelled,
"Come on, Romy, not again!"
The cop turned around and yelled back,
"Get out of here!"
The truck stopped on the center line, and the driver yelled,
"You gotta stop that, man!"
The cop unsnapped his holster, whipped out his black pistol, and said,
"You heard me! Get out of here!"
The truck lurched forward, spun its rear tires, and sped away. When it was 20 yards down the road, the cop aimed his pistol at the sky and fired a loud, thundering shot that cracked through the valley and echoed off the ridges. Samantha screamed and began crying. The cop watched the truck disappear, then said,
"It's okay. It's okay. He's always butting in. Now, where were we?"
He stuck the pistol back into the holster and fiddled with the snap as he talked.
"I don't know," she said, trying to wipe her eyes with trembling hands.
Frustrated, the cop said,
"It's okay, ma'am, it's okay. Now, you got a New York driver's license and Vermont tags on this little weird car, and you're 30 miles over. What are you doing down here?"
"Is it really any of your business?" she almost blurted. But an attitude would only cause more trouble.
She looked straight ahead, took deep breaths, and fought to compose herself. Finally, she said,
"I'm headed to Brady. I have a job interview."
Her ears were ringing. He laughed awkwardly and said,
Ain't no jobs in Brady, I can guarantee you that.
I have an interview with the Mountain Legal Aid Clinic, she said, teeth clenched, her own words hollow and surreal. This baffled him, and he seemed uncertain as to his next move.
Well, I gotta take you in. 30 over is extreme recklessness. Judge will probably throw the book at you. Gotta take you in.
In where?
To the county jail in Brady.
Her chin dropped to her chest, and she massaged her temples. I don't believe this, she said.
Sorry, ma'am. Get out of the car. I'll let you sit in my front seat.
He was standing with his hands on his hips, his right one dangerously close to his holster. Are you serious? She asked.
As a heart attack.
Can I make a phone call?
No way. Maybe at the jail. Besides, ain't no service out here.
You're arresting me and taking me to jail.
Now you're catching on. I'm sure we do things different down here in Virginia. Let's go.
What about my car?
Tow truck will come get it. Cost you another $40. Let's go.
She couldn't think clearly, but all other options seemed to end with more gunfire. Slowly, she grabbed her bag and got out of the car. At 5'7" and in flat shoes, she had at least 2 inches on Romy. She walked back to his car, its blue grill lights still flashing. She looked at the driver's door and saw nothing. He sensed what she was thinking and said,
It's an unmarked car. That's why you didn't see me back there. Works every time. Get in the front seat. I'll take you in with no handcuffs.
She managed to mumble a weak, Thanks. It was a dark blue Ford of some variety, and it vaguely resembled an old patrol car, one retired a decade earlier. The front seat was of the bench style, vinyl with large cracks that revealed dirty foam padding. 2 radios were stuck on the dashboard. Romy grabbed a mic and said, in rapid words, barely decipherable, something like,
Unit 10 inbound to Brady with subject, ETA 5 minutes, notify the judge. Need a wrecker at Thax Bridge, some kind of little weird Japanese car.
There was no response, as if no one was listening. Samantha wondered if the radio really worked. On the bench between them was a police scanner, it too as quiet as the radio. Romy hit a switch and turned off his lights.
You want to hear the siren?
He asked with a grin. A kid and his toys. She shook her head. No. And she thought yesterday had been the pits, with the 10 rejections and all. And the day before she'd been laid off and escorted out of the building. But now this, arrested in Podunk and hauled away to jail. Her heart pounded, and she had trouble swallowing. There were no seat belts. Romy hit the gas, and they were soon flying down the center of the highway, the old Ford rattling from bumper to bumper. After a mile or two, he said,
I'm really sorry about this. Just doing my job.
She asked, Are you a policeman or a deputy sheriff or something like that?
I'm a constable. Do primarily traffic enforcement.
She nodded as if this cleared up everything. He drove with his left wrist limped over the steering wheel, which was vibrating. On a flat stretch of road, he gunned the engine, and the turbulence increased. She glanced at the speedometer, which was not working. He barked into his mic again like a bad actor, and again, no one answered. They slid into a steep curve, much too fast, but when the car fishtailed, Romy calmly turned into the spin and tapped the brakes. I'm going to die, she thought. Either at the hands of a deranged killer or in a fiery crash. Her stomach flipped and she felt faint. She clutched her bag, closed her eyes, and began to pray. On the outskirts of Brady, she finally managed to breathe normally. If he planned to rape and murder her, and toss her body off a mountain, he
He wouldn't do it in town. They passed shops with gravel parking lots and rows of neat little houses, all painted white. There were church steeples rising above the trees when she looked up. Before they got to Main Street, Romy turned abruptly and slid into the unpaved parking lot of the Noland County Jail.
"Just follow me," he said.
For a split second, she was actually relieved to be at the jail. As she followed him toward the front door, she glanced around to make sure no one was watching. And who exactly was she worried about? Inside, they stopped in a cramped and dusty waiting area. To the left was a door with the word jail stenciled on it. Romy pointed to the right and said,
"You take a seat over there while I get the paperwork. And no funny stuff, okay?"
No one else was present. "Where would I go?" she asked. "I've lost my car."
"You just sit down and keep quiet."
She sat in a plastic chair, and he disappeared through the door. Evidently, the walls were quite thin, because she heard him say,
"Got a girl from New York out there. Picked her up at Dunn Spring, doing 51. Can you believe that?"
A male voice responded sharply,
"Oh, come on, Romy, not again."
"Yep,
nailed her." "You gotta stop that crap, Romy."
"Don't start with me again, Doug."
There were heavy footsteps as the voices grew muted, then disappeared. Then, from deeper in the jail, loud, angry voices erupted. Though she couldn't understand what was being said, it was obvious that at least two men were arguing with Romy. The voices went silent as the minutes passed. A chubby man in a blue uniform walked through the jail door and said,
"Howdy, are you Miss Kofer?"
"I am, yes," she answered, glancing around at the empty room. He handed her back her license and said,
"Just wait a minute, okay?"
"Sure." What else could she say? From the back, voices rose and fell, and then stopped completely. She sent a text to her mother, one to her father, and one to Blythe. If her body was never found, they would at least know a few of the details. The door opened again, and a young man entered the waiting room. He wore faded jeans, hiking boots, a fashionable sports coat, no tie. He offered her an easy smile and said,
"Are you Samantha Kofer?"
"I am." He pulled over another plastic chair, sat with their knees almost touching, and said,
"My name is Donovan Gray. I'm your attorney, and I've just gotten all charges dismissed. I suggest we get out of here as soon as possible."
As he spoke, he gave her a business card, which she glanced at. It appeared to be legitimate. His office was on Main Street in Brady.
"Okay, and where will we be going?" she asked carefully.
"Back to get your car."
"What about that constable?"
"I'll explain as we go."
They hurried from the jail and got into a late model Jeep Cherokee. When he started the engine, Springsteen roared from the stereo, and he quickly turned it off. He was between 35 and 40, she guessed, with shaggy dark hair, at least 3 days' worth of stubble, and dark, sad eyes. As they backed away, she said,
"Wait, I need to text some people."
"Sure, you'll have good service for a few miles."
She texted her mother, father, and Blythe with the news that she was no longer at the jail, and things seemed to be improving under the circumstances.
"Don't worry, yet."
She felt safer for the moment. She would call and explain later. When the town was behind them, he began,
"Romy's not really a cop, or a constable, or anyone with any authority.
The first thing you need to understand is that he's not all there. Got a couple of screws loose. Maybe more. He's always wanted to be the sheriff. And so, from time to time, he feels compelled to go on patrol. Always around Dunn Spring. If you're passing through and you're from out of state, then Romy will take notice. If your license plates are from, say, Tennessee or North Carolina, then Romy won't bother you. But if you're from up north, then Romy gets excited, and he might do what he did to you. He really thinks he's doing a good thing by hauling in reckless drivers, especially folks from New York and Vermont. Why doesn't someone stop him?
Oh, we try. Everybody yells at him. But you can't watch him 24 hours a day. He's very sneaky, and he knows these roads better than anyone. Usually, he'll just pull over the reckless driver, some poor guy from New Jersey, scare the hell out of him, and let him go. No one ever knows about it. But occasionally, he'll show up at the jail with someone in custody and insist that they be locked up. I'm not believing this. He's never hurt anyone, but he fired a shot at another driver. My ears are still ringing. Okay, look, he's crazy, like a lot of folks around here.
Then lock him up. Surely there are laws against false arrest and kidnapping.
His cousin is the sheriff. She took a deep breath and shook her head. It's true. His cousin has been our sheriff for a long time. Romy is very envious of this. In fact, he once ran against the sheriff. Got about 10 votes countywide, and that really upset him. He was stopping Yankees right and left until they sent him away for a few months.
Send him away again.
It's not that simple. You're actually lucky he didn't take you to his jail.
His jail?
Donovan was smiling and enjoying his narrative.
Oh, yes. About 5 years ago, Romy's brother found a late model sedan with Ohio tags parked behind a barn on their family's farm. He looked around, heard a noise, and found this guy from Ohio locked in a horse stall. It turns out Romy had fixed up the stall with chicken wire and barbed wire, and the poor guy had been there for 3 days. He had plenty of food and was quite comfortable. He said Romy checked on him several times a day and couldn't have been nicer.
You're making this up.
I am not. Romy was off his meds and going through a bad time. Things got ugly. The guy from Ohio raised hell and hired lawyers. They sued Romy for false imprisonment and a bunch of other stuff, and the case went nowhere. He has no assets, except for his patrol car, so a civil suit is worthless. They insisted he be prosecuted for kidnapping and so on, and Romy eventually pled guilty to a minor charge. He spent 30 days in jail. Not his jail, but the county jail. Then got sent back to the state mental facility for a tune-up. He's not a bad guy, really.
A charmer.
Frankly, some of the other cops around here are more dangerous. I like Romy. I once handled a case for his uncle. Meth.
Meth?
Crystal methamphetamine. After coal, it's probably the biggest cash crop in these parts.
Can I ask you something that might seem a bit personal?
Sure. I'm your lawyer. You can ask me anything.
Why do you have that gun in the console?
She nodded at the console just below her left elbow. In plain view was a rather large black pistol.
It's legal. I make a lot of enemies.
What kind of enemies?
I sue coal companies.
She assumed an explanation would take some time, so she took a deep breath and watched the road. After recounting Romy's adventures, Donovan seemed content to enjoy the silence. She realized he had not asked what she was doing in Nolan County, the obvious question.
At Thack's Bridge, he turned around in the middle of the road and parked behind the Prius. She said, "So, do I owe you a fee?"
"Sure.
A cup of coffee."
"Coffee? Around here?"
"No. There's a nice cafe back in town. Maddie's in court and will likely be tied up until 5, so you have some time to kill."
She wanted to say something, but words failed her. He continued, "Maddie's my aunt. She's the reason I went to law school, and she helped me through. I worked with her clinic while I was a student, then for 3 years after I passed the bar. Now I'm on my own."
And Maddie told you I would show up for an interview? For the first time, she noticed a wedding ring on his finger. A coincidence. I often stop by her office early in the morning for coffee and gossip. She mentioned all these emails from New York lawyers suddenly looking for do-gooder work. Said one might show up today for an interview. It's kind of amusing, really, for lawyers like us down here to see big firm lawyers running for the hills. Our hills. Then I happened to be at the jail seeing a client when your pal Romy showed up with a new trophy. And here we are. I wasn't planning to return to Brady. In fact, I was planning to turn that little red car around and get the hell out of here. Well, slow down when you go through Dunn Spring. Don't worry. A pause as they stared at the Prius. Then he said, "Okay, I'll buy the coffee. I think you'll enjoy meeting Maddie. I wouldn't blame you for leaving, but first impressions are often wrong. Brady is a nice town, and Maddie has a lot of clients who could use your help." I didn't bring my gun. He smiled and said, "Maddie doesn't carry one either." "Then what kind of lawyer is she?" "She's a great lawyer, who's totally committed to her clients, none of whom can pay her. Give it a shot. At least talk to her." "My specialty is financing skyscrapers in Manhattan. I'm not sure I'm cut out for whatever work Maddie does." "You'll catch on quick, and you'll love it because you'll be helping people who need you. People with real problems." Samantha took a deep breath. Her instincts said, "Run." To where exactly? But her sense of adventure convinced her to at least see the town again. If her lawyer carried a gun, wasn't that some measure of protection? "I'm buying," she said. "Consider it your fee." "Okay, follow me." "Should I worry about Romy?" "No, I had a chat with him, as did his cousin. Just stay on my bumper." A quick tour of Main Street revealed six blocks of turn-of-the-century buildings, a fourth of them empty with fading for-sale signs taped to the windows. Donovan's law office was a two-story with large windows and his name painted in small letters. Upstairs, a balcony hung over the sidewalk. Across the street and down three blocks was the old hardware store, now the home of the Mountain Legal Aid Clinic. At the far west end was a small, handsome courthouse, home to most of the folks who ran Nolan County. They stepped into the Brady Grill and took a booth near the back. As they walked by a table, three men glared at Donovan, who seemed not to notice. A waitress brought them coffee. Samantha leaned in low and said quietly, "Those three men up there, they seem to dislike you. Do you know them?" He glanced over his shoulder, then nodded and said, "I know everyone in Brady. And I'd guess that maybe half of them hate my guts. As I said, I sue coal companies, and coal is the biggest employer around here."
"It's the biggest employer throughout Appalachia."
"And why do you sue them?" He smiled, took a sip of coffee, and glanced at his watch. "This might take some time. I'm really not that busy." "Well, coal companies create a lot of problems, most of them anyway. There are a couple of decent ones, but most care nothing about the environment or their employees. Mining coal is a dirty business, always has been, but it's far worse now. Have you heard of mountaintop removal?"
"No."
"Also known as strip mining. They started mining coal in these parts back in the 1800s. Deep mining, where they bored tunnels into the mountains and extracted the coal. Mining has been a way of life here since then. My grandfather was a miner, so was his father. My dad was another story. Anyway, by 1920, there were 800,000 coal miners in the coal fields, from Pennsylvania down to Tennessee. Coal mining is dangerous work, and it has a rich history of labor troubles, union fights, violence, corruption, all manner of historical drama. All deep mining, which was the traditional way, very labor-intensive. Around 1970, coal companies decided they could strip mine and save millions on labor costs. Strip mining is far cheaper than deep mining because it requires much fewer workers. Today, there are only 80,000 coal miners left, and half of them work above the ground for the strip miners. The waitress walked by, and Donovan stopped for a second. He took a sip of coffee, glanced casually around, waited until she was gone, and continued. Mountaintop removal is nothing but strip mining on steroids.
Appalachian coal is found in seams, sort of like layers of cake.
At the top of the mountain, there's the forest, then a layer of topsoil, then a layer of rock, and finally, a seam of coal. Could be 4 feet thick, could be 20. When a coal company gets a permit to strip mine, it literally attacks the mountain with all manner of heavy equipment. First, it clear-cuts the trees, total deforestation with no effort at saving the hardwoods. They are bulldozed away as the earth is scalped. Same for the topsoil, which is not very thick. Next comes the layer of rock, which is blasted out of the ground. The trees, topsoil, and rock are often shoved into the valleys between the mountains, creating what's known as valley fills. These wipe out vegetation, wildlife, and natural streams. Just another environmental disaster. If you're downstream, you're just screwed. As you'll learn around here, we're all downstream. And this is legal? Yes and no. Strip mining is legal because of federal law, but the actual process is loaded with illegal activities. We have a long, ugly history of the regulators and watchdogs being too cozy with the coal companies. Reality is always the same. The coal companies run roughshod over the land and the people because they have the money and the power. Back to the cake. You were down to the seam of coal. Yeah, well, once they find the coal, they bring in more machines, extract it, haul it out, and continue blasting down to the next seam. It's not unusual to demolish the top 500 feet of a mountain. This takes relatively few workers. In fact, a small crew can thoroughly destroy a mountain in a matter of months. The waitress refilled their cups, and Donovan watched in silence, totally ignoring her. When she disappeared, he leaned in a bit lower and said, "Once the coal is hauled out by truck, it's washed, which is another disaster. Coal washing creates a black sludge that contains toxic chemicals and heavy metals. The sludge is also known as slurry, a term you'll hear often. Since it can't be disposed of, the coal companies store it behind earthen dams and sludge ponds, or slurry ponds. The engineering is slipshod and half-assed, and these things break all the time with catastrophic results. They store it for how long?" Donovan shrugged and glanced around. He wasn't nervous or frightened. He just didn't want to be heard. He was calm and articulate, with a slight mountain twang, and Samantha was captivated, both by his narrative and his dark eyes. "They store it forever. No one cares. They store it until the dam breaks and there's a tidal wave of toxic crud running down the mountain, into homes and schools and towns, destroying everything. You've heard of the famous Exxon Valdez tanker spill, where a tanker ran into the rocks in Alaska? 30 million gallons of crude oil dumped into pristine waters. Front page news for weeks, and the entire country was pissed. Remember all those otters covered with black muck? But I'll bet you haven't heard of the Martin County spill, the largest environmental disaster east of the Mississippi. It happened 8 years ago in Kentucky, when a slurry impoundment broke and 300 million gallons of sludge rolled down the valley. 10 times more than the Valdez. And it was a non-event around the country. You know why? Okay, why? Because it's Appalachia. The coal companies are destroying our mountains, towns, culture, and lives. And it's not a story. So why do these guys hate your guts? Because they believe strip mining is a good thing. It provides jobs. And there are a few jobs around here. They're not bad people. They're just misinformed and misguided. Mountaintop removal is killing our communities. It has single-handedly wiped out tens of thousands of jobs. People are forced to leave their homes because of blasting, dust, sludge, and flooding. The roads aren't safe because of these massive trucks flying down the mountains.
I filed 5 wrongful death cases in the past 5 years. Folks crushed by trucks carrying 90 tons of coal.
Many towns have simply vanished. The coal companies often buy up surrounding homes and tear them down. Every county in coal country has lost population in the past 20 years. Yet a lot of people, including those 3 gentlemen over there, think that a few jobs are better than none. If they are gentlemen, then why do you carry a gun? Because certain coal companies have been known to hire thugs. It's intimidation, or worse, and it's nothing new. Look, Samantha, I'm a son of the coal country, a hillbilly and a proud one. And I could tell you stories for hours about the bloody history of big coal. Do you really fear for your life? He paused and looked away for a second. There were 1,000 murders in New York City last year. Did you fear for your life? Not really. He smiled and nodded and said, same here. We had 3 murders last year, all related to meth. You just have to be careful. A phone vibrated in his pocket and he yanked it out. He read the text, then said, it's Maddie. She's out of court. Back at the office and ready to see you. Wait, how did she know I would be with you? It's a small town, Samantha. Chapter 6. They walked along the sidewalk until they came to his office, where they shook hands. She thanked him for his pro bono work as her attorney and complimented him on a job well done. And if she decided to hang around the town for a few months, they promised to do lunch at the Brady Grill someday. It was almost 5 p.m. when she hustled across the street, jaywalking, and half expecting to be arrested for it. She glanced to the west, where the mountains were already blocking the late afternoon sun. The shadows consumed the town and gave it the feel of early winter. A bell clinked on the door when she entered the cluttered front room of the legal aid clinic. A busy desk indicated that someone was usually there to answer the phone and greet the clients, but for the moment, the reception area was empty. She looked around, waited, took in the surroundings. The office layout was simple. A narrow hall ran straight down the middle of what had been for decades the busy domain of the town's hardware store. Everything had the look and feel of being old and well used. The walls were whitewashed partitions that did not quite make it all the way to the copper-tiled ceiling. The floors were covered with thin, ragged carpet. The furniture, at least in the reception, was a mismatched collection of flea market leftovers. The walls, though, were exhibiting an interesting collection of oils and pastels by local artists, all for sale at very reasonable prices. The artwork. The prior year, the equity partners at Scully and Pershing had gone to war over a designer's proposal to spend $2 million on some baffling avant-garde paintings to be hung in the firm's main foyer. The designer was ultimately fired, the paintings forgotten, and the money split into bonuses. Halfway down the hall, a door opened, and a short, slightly stocky woman in bare feet stepped out. I take it you're Samantha, she said, walking toward her. I'm Maddie Wyatt. I understand you had a rather rude welcome to Nolan County. I'm so sorry. Nice to meet you, Samantha said, as she stared at the bright pink and square reading glasses perched on the end of Maddie's nose. The pink of her glasses matched the pink tips of her hair, which was short, spiked, and dyed a severe white. It was a look Samantha had never seen before, but one that was working, here at least. Of course, she had seen looks far funkier in Manhattan, but never on a lawyer. "In here," Maddie said, as she waved at her office. Once inside, she closed the door and said, "I guess that nut Romy will have to hurt someone before the sheriff does anything. I'm very sorry. Have a seat." "It's okay, I'm fine. And now I have a story that I'm sure I'll tell for many years." "Indeed you will. And if you hang around here, you'll collect a lot of stories. Would you like some coffee?" She fell into a rocking chair behind a desk that seemed perfectly organized. "No, thanks. I just had coffee with your nephew." "Yes, of course. I'm so glad you met Donovan. He's one of the bright spots around here. I practically raised him, you know. Tragic family and all. He's thoroughly committed to his work, and rather pleasant to look at, don't you think?" "He's nice," Samantha said cautiously, unwilling to comment on his looks, and determined to stay away from his family's tragedy. "Anyway, here's where we are. I'm supposed to meet another castaway from Wall Street tomorrow, and that's it. I don't have a lot of time to spend interviewing, you know. I got 4 more emails today, and I've stopped answering them. I'll check out this guy tomorrow, and then our board will meet and pick the winner."
"Okay. Who's on the board?"
"It's basically just Donovan and me. Annette is another lawyer here, and she would be invited to the interviews, but she's out of town. We work pretty quick, not a lot of red tape. If we decide to go with you, when can you start?"
"I don't know. Things are happening pretty fast."
"I thought you weren't that busy these days."
"True. I guess I could start sooner rather than later. But I would like a day or two to think about it," Samantha said, trying to relax in a stiff wooden chair that tilted when she breathed. "I'm just not sure."
"Okay, that's fine. It's not like a new intern will make a big difference around here. We've had them before, you know. In fact, we had a full-blown fellow for 2 years a while back, a kid from the coal fields who went to law school at Stanford, then hired on with a big firm in Philadelphia."
"What did he do here?"
"She, Evelyn. And she worked with Black Lung and Mine Safety. A hard worker and very bright. But then she was gone after 2 years and left us with a bunch of open files. Wonder if she's on the streets these days. Must be awful up there."
"It is. Pardon me for saying so, Ms. Wyatt, but it's Maddie."
"Okay, Maddie. But you don't seem too thrilled at the idea of an intern."
"Ugh, forgive me.
I'm sorry. No, actually, we need all the help we can get. As I told you on the phone, there's no shortage of poor folks with legal problems around here. These people can't afford lawyers. Unemployment is high, meth use is even higher, and the coal companies are brilliant when it comes to finding new ways to screw people. Believe me, dear, we need all the help we can get."
"What will I be doing?"
"Everything from answering the phone to opening the mail to filing federal lawsuits. Your resume says you're licensed in both Virginia and New York."
"I clerked for a judge in D.C. after law school and passed the Virginia bar exam."
"Have you seen the inside of a courtroom in the past 3 years?"
"No."
Maddie hesitated for a second, as if this might be a deal breaker. "Well, I guess you're lucky in one sense. Don't suppose you've been to jail either?"
"Not since this afternoon."
"Oh, right. Again, sorry about that. You'll catch on quick. What type of work were you doing in New York?" Samantha took a deep breath and thought of ways to truthfully duck the question. Invention failed her, and she said, "I was in commercial real estate. Pretty boring stuff, actually. Incredibly boring. We represented a bunch of unpleasant rich guys
who build tall buildings up and down the East Coast, primarily in New York. As a mid-level associate, I normally spent my time reviewing financing agreements with banks, thick contracts that had to be prepared and proofread by someone. Just above the pink and square frames, Maddie's eyes offered a look of pure pity. Sounds awful. It was. Still is, I guess. Are you relieved to be away from that? I don't know how I feel, Maddie, to be honest. A month ago, I was scrambling along in the rat race, elbowing others and getting elbowed myself, racing toward something. I can't even remember what it was. There were dark clouds out there, but we were too busy to notice. Then Lehman went under, and for 2 weeks, I was afraid of my shadow. We worked even harder, hoping that someone might notice, hoping that 100 hours a week might save us where 90 hours would not. Suddenly, it was over, and we were tossed into the street. No severance, nothing. Nothing but a few promises that I doubt anyone can keep. Maddie looked as if she might cry. Would you go back? I don't know right now. I don't think so. I didn't like the work, didn't like most of the people in the firm, and certainly didn't like the clients. Sadly, most of the lawyers I know feel the same way. Well, dear, here at the Mountain Legal Aid Clinic, we love our clients, and they love us. I'm sure they're much nicer than the ones I dealt with. Maddie glanced at her watch, a bright yellow dial strapped to her wrist with green vinyl, and said, "What are your plans for the evening?" Samantha shrugged and shook her head. "Haven't thought that far ahead." "Well, you certainly can't drive back to Washington tonight. Does Romy work the night shift? Are the roads safe?" Maddie chuckled and said, "The roads are treacherous. You can't go. Let's start with dinner, and then we'll go from there." "No, seriously, I can't." "Nonsense. Samantha, you're in Appalachia now, deep in the mountains, and we do not turn visitors away at dinner time. My house is just around the corner, and my husband is an excellent cook. Let's have a drink on the porch and talk about stuff. I'll tell you everything you need to know about Brady." Maddie found her shoes and locked up the office. She said the Prius was safe where it was parked on Main Street. "I walk to work," Maddie said. "About my only exercise." The shops and offices were closed. The two cafes were serving an early dinner to thin crowds. They trudged up the side of a hill, passing kids on the sidewalk and neighbors on porches. After two blocks, they turned onto Third Street, a leafy row of turn-of-the-century, neat red brick homes, almost all identical with white porches and gabled roofs. Samantha wanted to hit the road, to hurry back toward Abingdon, where she had noticed several chain motels at the interchange. But there was no way to gracefully say no to Maddie's hospitality. Chester Wyatt was in a rocking chair, reading a newspaper, when he was introduced to Samantha. "I told her you are an excellent cook," Maddie said. "I guess that means I'm cooking dinner," he said with a grin. "Welcome." "And she's starving," Maddie said. "What would you like?" he asked. "I'm fine," Samantha said. Maddie said, "What about baked chicken with Spanish rice?" "Just what I was thinking," Chester said. "A glass of wine first?" They drank red wine for an hour as darkness settled around them. Samantha sipped slowly, careful not to have too much, because she was worrying about her drive out of Noland County. There appeared to be no hotels or motels in Brady, and given the town's declining appearance, she doubted there was a suitable room anywhere. As they talked, she politely probed here and there and learned that the Wyatts had two adult children who had fled the area after college. There were three grandchildren they rarely saw. Donovan was like a son. Chester was a retired postal worker who had delivered rural mail for decades and knew everyone. Now he volunteered for an environmental group that monitored strip mining and filed complaints with a dozen bureaucracies. His father and grandfather had been coal miners. Maddie's father had worked the deep mines for almost 30 years before dying of black lung at the age of 61. "I'm 61 now," she said. "It was horrible." While the women sat and talked, Chester eased back and forth to the kitchen, checking on the chicken and pouring wine. Once, when he was gone, Maddie said, "Don't worry, dear. We have an extra bedroom." "No, really, please, I insist. There's not a decent room in town, believe me. A couple of hot sheets joints that charge by the hour. But even they're about to close. A sad commentary, I suppose. Folks used to sneak off to the motel for illicit sex. Now they just move in together and play house." "So there is sex around here?" Samantha asked.
"I should hope so.
My mother had 7 kids. Chester's had 6. There's not much else to do. And this time of year, September and October, they're popping out like rabbits."
"Why?"
"Big storm just after Christmas." Chester stepped through the screen door and asked, "What are we talking about?"
"Sex," Maddie said.
Samantha's surprised that folks have sex around here.
"Some of them do," he said.
"So I've heard," Maddie shot back with a grin.
"I didn't bring up sex," Samantha said defensively. "Maddie mentioned an extra bedroom for the night."
"Yes, and it's all yours.
Just keep your door locked and we'll stay out of trouble," Chester said as he disappeared into the house.
"He's harmless, believe me," Maddie whispered. Donovan arrived to say hello, and thankfully missed that part of the conversation. He lived on a mountain out in the country and was on his way home from the office. He declined an offer of wine and left after 15 minutes. He seemed distracted and said he was tired.
"Poor thing," Maddie said when he was gone.
"He and his wife have separated. She moved back to Roanoke with their daughter, a 5-year-old who's about the cutest thing you'll ever see. His wife, Judy, never adjusted to life here in the mountains and just got fed up. I don't feel good about them. Do you, Chester?"
Chester said, "Not really. Judy is a wonderful person, but she was never happy here. Then, when the trouble started, she sort of cracked up. That's when she left."
The word trouble hung in the air for a few seconds, and when neither of the Wyatts chose to pursue it, Chester said,
"Dinner's ready."
Samantha followed them into the kitchen, where the table was set for 3. Chester served from the stove, steaming chicken with rice and homemade rolls. Maddie placed a salad bowl in the